The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Joanna LaForgia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Southern Living. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2026 issue of Southern Living magazine. We'll start with the first regular feature, which is Life at SL, the editor's essay. And then we'll move on to a piece called The Church That Changed the World. Okay. The cover of this magazine is, it's a pink, it's a watermelon pink, crossed between different shades of watermelon or strawberry red and pink. That's the whole tone. The background is blurred, but it's suggestive of the pattern of a strawberry because it's red with these white, little white spots in it or white diamonds in it. And in the foreground, upon a table with a, appears to be red plastic, dark red or dark pink plastic tablecloth, upon that table is a glass pedestal plate, cake plate, pedestal cake plate. And upon that is a strawberry lemonade jelly mold. It's a bright fire engine red. It looks slippery, shiny in the light and slick. So it looks like it's very slippery. And it's filled with fruits. We can't quite discern what they are. But we could guess because the top of that jelly mold, there are lemons and strawberries sitting there. And there's a strawberry on the plate itself in the foreground. From the top to bottom, the print on the cover in green is Southern Living 60 years. That's in white, special anniversary issue. The South's best new hotels, barbecue joints, beach towns, restaurants, and more. Our most iconic recipes, the next great food city, Ivy Odom's favorite cake, the church that changed the world, plus the best crawfish in Cajun country. Okay, are we ready? Each issue of the magazine begins with a feature called Life in S at SL, and that is the editor's essay. And those always begin with a quote. And here's this month's quote. Remember to celebrate milestones as you prepare for the road ahead. And that quote is by Nelson Mandela. Life at SL, a time to celebrate. Cheers to 6 decades and a fresh start. And that refers, of course, to Southern Living 60 years. And there's a photo here, listeners, of three people behind a bar. There's some bottles and glasses on the shelves behind them. And they are, from left, design director Daniel Boone, director of photography Gene Clayton, and photographer Robbie Caponetto at Current Charcoal Grill in Birmingham. And they appear to be in their 40s, maybe 50s. And one man is wearing a plaid, buffalo plaid shirt of orange and black. The tones are all burnt orange, autumnal tones, and black and gray. And this man's wearing a button-down, a shirt opened over a T-shirt. He's got black glasses and a beard and mustache and brown hair. Everyone's smiling happily. The woman is in the middle. She has sunglasses upon her forehead, blonde hair. And she's wearing a burnt orange shirt with a brown scarf around her neck, short, a small one. And the other man is bald with glasses, and he has a teal t-shirt on beneath a brown and white buffalo plaid button-down shirt. And they're standing close, like kind of hugging each other. They've got glasses there. All right. Here's our story. Welcome to our 60th anniversary issue. This is a milestone for Southern Living. And just in case you don't read any further, I want to thank you for getting us here. Part of the magic of this magazine is that so many of the recipes, ideas, and stories have come from you, our readers. You've led us into your homes, your backyards, and your gardens. You've told us about the back roads you love to drive, your favorite barbecue joints, and the best places to get a po' boy in New Orleans. You've shared your Easter Sunday rituals, your grandmother's etiquette advice, and the desserts that have been passed down in your family for generations, like the cane cake on page 124 of this issue of the magazine. And listeners, I did not read that correctly. It's like the Lane cake, L-A-N-E cake. All right, I guess we'll have to get to that at some point. All right. The stories in these pages are yours, and we couldn't have done it without you. I also want to acknowledge the countless people who have worked for Southern Living since our founding in 1966. There are too many to name, from editors and photographers to writers and designers, from food stylists and recipe developers to digital storytellers and social media experts. From researchers and garden pros to the business folks who keep the books straight, there's always been a sense that Southern Living is a sacred trust, a keeper of the traditions that define us and give us our unique identity. That's what makes the job so meaningful. This brand has also been a longtime champion of a diverse and welcoming South. We may share similar values, but it's the differences in our accents, cooking styles, and backgrounds that give the region its soul. To mark the occasion, we wanted to create an issue that would honor the past, but also look to the future. It seemed appropriate to put our strawberry lemonade jelly mold on the cover, because some things will never go out of style. We brought you a nostalgic recipe for butter mints and Ivy Odom's Little Layer chocolate cake with its South Georgia roots. We're shining a light on your favorite destinations in our 10th annual South's Best Awards, voted on by thousands of readers. We also decided to take a close look at our hometown of Birmingham, the epicenter of the civil rights movement. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist John Archibald, finds a ray of hope in the story of 16th Street Baptist Church, which has broken ground on a new education and visitor center. And we came up with 60 delicious reasons why this former steel town has emerged as the South's next great food city. And listeners, that's the title of an article that we might get to later this month. Speaking of new things, you might notice a few changes as you turn the pages. Oh, don't worry. The Grumpy Gardener and Rick Bragg are still here. But we've done a little redecorating. There are updated fonts to improve readability, fresh colors that tie directly to the seasons, and a cleaner look that places more emphasis on photography. We're introducing a column by Georgia designer James Farmer called Let's Celebrate, which is all about making the most of the holidays. In this case, Easter. And we're heading to Hawk's Crawfish Restaurant in Louisiana to kick off a periodic series called Cult Classic, which will help you find those hidden gems that are always worth the detour. Like so much of what we do around here, this issue represents a huge team effort. But we got an extra lift from the designers, photo editors, and photographers who brought our new look to life. Their creative energy is inspiring, and I know they hope you'll like it as much as I do. Now that I think of it, I should probably write each of them an old school thank you note. As much as we want this issue to represent a step into the future, something should never change. And that, listeners, is by Sid Evans, the editor-in-chief of Southern Living Magazine. You can reach him at sid@southernliving.com. That's S as in Sam, I, D as in David, at southernliving.com. And now on to the cover story, one of the cover stories, The Church That Changed the World by John Archibald. Birmingham's 16th Street Baptist Church still welcomes visitors with outstretched arms and a spirit of hope. And there's a double page photo of it here, listeners, of the inside of the church. Excuse me, we're looking down on it from the balcony, which we can see a bit of on our right and left side. It's a horseshoe shaped facing the altar. It's a modest wooden altar. There are red velvet chairs all around. This is on the stage, so to speak, which is carpeted in red velvet. There are the traditional pews that we see. The church is empty now. There's a grand piano to our left, right beside those steps we just spoke of, and an American flag close to that. There's a lectern on either side of this. They're down on the floor for now, a few lecterns. And we are facing, behind the altar, a place where I imagine the choir is seated. Just these are instead of red chairs, these are gold-toned chairs. And above that, it appears to be about 100 organ pipes, gold organ pipes. All right, let's start. Lisa McNair was born in the shadow of death. She arrived to Maxine and Chris McNair on September 19th, 1964. 1 year and 4 days after Klansmen blew a hole in their church and an even bigger one in their lives. On a mild September Sunday, those bombers, enraged by the prospect of desegregation and whipped into a frenzy by local and state politicians, left the explosive equivalent of about 10 sticks of dynamite outside that church, below and just to the right of a stained glass window depicting Jesus holding a shepherd's crook. On the other side of that window, the Reverend John H. Cross previewed the morning sermon entitled A Love That Forgives to a Sunday school class. The attackers had fashioned a rudimentary timing device, excuse me, from a fishing bobber in a leaky bucket of water. The liquid drained away at 10:22 on the morning of September 15th, 1963. That flimsy bobber did its job and triggered the most deadly terrorist act of the civil rights movement. Those men, none of whom would be tried in court for another decade and a half, murdered 4 girls, Cynthia Wesley, Carol Robertson, Addie Mae Collins, and Denise McNair. Denise would be forever 11 to her little sister, Lisa. But they would never meet. Addie May's younger sister, Sarah Collins Rudolph, was pulled alive from the rubble. Sylvester Norris drove the ambulance that rushed her, blinded by the blast, to the hospital. Rudolph was conscious, he told police. He knew because she sang, "Jesus loves me. Yes, Jesus loves me," on the way. The bombing changed those people, those families, forever. It jarred a city, a region, and a nation. When Dr. Martin Luther King spoke at the combined funeral, he talked about another dream of wringing good from evil so their deaths would not be in vain. The spilled blood of these innocent girls may cause the whole citizenry of Birmingham to transform the negative extremes of a dark past into the positive extremes of a bright future, King said. Indeed, this tragic event may cause the white South to come to terms with its conscience. The murders did, almost instantly, alter the way many people across the globe looked at racial violence. The crimes began to change the way the South saw itself, too. "And who is really guilty?" a white lawyer named Charles Morgan Jr. famously asked in a speech at a downtown Birmingham civic club the day after the bombing. Excuse me. "We are a mass of intolerance and bigotry and stand indicted before our young," he said. "We are cursed by the failure of each of us to accept responsibility." McNair arrived in a world of conflict and grief. She was thrust by circumstances she did not choose into a life directed by the death of a sister she would know only from pictures, stories, and news clips. She would fall into a role she never auditioned to play. But in time, she learned to make it her own. Her most important part would be hope. A higher calling. Birmingham is a young city by Southern standards, a post-Civil War industrial boom town forged by coal and steel and upheaval. It was founded in 1871, and only 2 years later, 16th Street Baptist was born. It was known at the time as the first colored Baptist church. From the start, it was a quiet symbol of persecution and persistence. The congregation raised money and, in 1884, built a steepled sanctuary at its current location. According to the Reverend Arthur Price, who's been the church's pastor for the past 24 years, after the building was completed, the powers who ran the city declared that the steeple was too tall and demanded that the church be demolished. And so it was. The congregation raised more funds, and a black architect named Wallace Rayfield fashioned a new design in a modified Romanesque and Byzantine style. Construction began under the direction of a black contractor. It finally opened in 1911. The brick church stands today on that corner of 16th Street and 6th Avenue North, in the heart of Birmingham, the Civil Rights District. It appears, they say, much as it did in 1911. It certainly looks a lot like it did in the 1950s, when many of the city's prominent black families prayed beneath a welcoming window depicting Christ as a shepherd during an era when they were unwelcome in restaurants, parks, and schools here. Across 6th Avenue today is the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. In the same block is the A.G. Gaston Motel, where King often stayed when he visited. Catty corner from the church is Kelly Ingram Park, now filled with statues commemorating the time in the spring of 1963 when police turned German shepherds and fire hoses on peaceful young protesters. Beyond that is the historic 4th Avenue Business District, where black shops and offices were largely relegated until the 1960s, and the Carver Theater, where black people could find entertainment without being forced into nosebleed seats. And listeners, there's an old black and white photo, obviously taken in 1963, when it's of the church, of a part of the church, and we can see cars, and there were several policemen with rifles walking around. And the windows are, some windows are blown out, and there's a broken stained glass window, arched window, bleeding off the left side of the photograph. And there is an inset of a little girl holding a doll. She's a blonde doll. She's an African-American little girl smiling with a cotton pinafore on, with long sleeves and cuffs. And she's holding the doll. The doll's face is beside her. And the caption is, Denise McNair was just 11 years old when she was killed in the bombing. And that's the photo we just described, listeners. Her father, Chris McNair, took this photo of the church on the day of the attack. And back to our story. The three-block stretch is a history lesson, a time capsule, a shocking reminder of a past not so long ago when it was illegal in cities like Birmingham for the races to mingle, to so much as dine together. When separate but equal, quote-unquote, was the law, but separate but less, quote-unquote, was the reality. People seeking to understand history and how it affects the present make regular pilgrimages to this place of revolution and reconciliation, as a sign at the park now labels it. It is an emotional journey. As visitors look outward, they often find themselves looking inward. Over half of my group will stay in the church for 30 minutes, not talking, crying, says Jeff Steinberg, a Californian who has brought 123 tours, totaling more than 210,000 people to Birmingham. And they're not thinking about the little girls. They're thinking about themselves and what their role is in all of this. I mean, it's quite powerful. A group of tourists from Germany came in the fall. As with those Steinberg brings here, they meditated in the church. They spoke in hushed tones as they wound through the sculpture path in Kelly Ingram Park, beside bronze water cannons aimed at bronze children, through a pack of bronze dogs lunging with their bronze fangs bared. Inside the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute, Carolyn McKinstry told them how the sanctuary at 16th Street shook that morning, how there was no carpet on the floor, so the sound was deafening, how she hid beneath a pew until she heard footsteps running toward her. I was 15 years old, but I would be 15 for the next 20 years, she told that group. It took me that long to process it all. The attack on this church did not happen in a vacuum, and people are often stunned by the history. Birmingham saw dozens of bombings in the decades prior, as the U.S. Supreme Court paved the way for desegregation of neighborhoods and schools. Threats to the church began in the spring of 1963, when demonstrators met there to organize protests and marches. Bomb threats had been called in a number of times, including two on the Sunday before the blast. Police rarely, if ever, took them seriously. You can talk of the past until you're blue in the face, but it is when visitors sit in those pews beneath the surviving stained glass window that they begin to understand. It is when they hear from people like McNair, McKinstry, and Rudolph that they begin to feel. Todd Allen has brought tourists from across the country to see civil rights sites over the last quarter century, many of them to Birmingham. The buildings are powerful, but the people even more so, he said, describing how this city can't help but make visitors reassess their own lives and the way they greet each day. You know, sometimes we talk about it kind of in this abstract sense, particularly those of us who are tourists, Allen said. But then you sit with people like Lisa and Carolyn and see the ways they live out on the daily, that love, that forgiveness. I get mad even when somebody cuts me off in traffic. Yet those people whose friends and family members were killed, whose lives were shaped by racial violence, speak of the transformational power of love and reconciliation. To me, all of that comes out of that place and out of that space, Allen says. Reverend Cross never got to deliver his sermon from his pulpit on the day of the bombing. But in the chaos after the blast, amid the smoke and the sirens and the screaming, he picked up a megaphone and began to speak it. Father, forgive them, because they know not what they do, he said. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Southern Living. We hope you enjoyed listening, and we hope you'll join us next time. I'm Joanna LaForgia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Southern Living is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number once more is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. So long till next time.